started a new recording. So, where are we? Did I get to the end of this slide? Yes, and I just, at the end of the slide, I said that at this point, you should just be able to read that and say, don't you don't need to comment on that, John, because it says it with such economy. Yes. So intention. Yes. Yeah. Yeah. That's the idea. The idea, really, at the end of the course is that you read Husserl and say, "Yeah, clear as a bell."
No worries.
Clear as a bell. Yes. So intentionality. What we're doing here is we're just looking at the reading for this week, which is from.
Yeah.
This is the book.
Wow.
And we're just. Yeah, we're just we're just going through it. Wes wants to come in. Yes, Wes.
She's in the wrong class.
Equalities
in education. Yeah.
But the people programmation today, three classes at the same moment. The first class is the inequality in education. The second class that program the people in here is the philosophy and conscience. And the feminist and intersectional theologies.
Yeah.
I agree in the packets.
Yeah. Equalities in education is that in the computer room at the end?
Yes.
That's just started, hasn't it?
Yeah.
Yes, it's exactly in the same packet.
Yeah, but that one's just started. This one's coming to an end. If you want to start, that's all I'm saying.
I read this in my secondary.
See?
The phenomenology.
Yes.
With my philosophy.
But if you want to study it, you really should come next year.
Yes,
if you're
no
still
problem.
Here, it's still, because
no
I'll
problem.
Do. I'll be doing it next.
I just did the challenge.
Yeah, next September, we'll start again.
No problem. No, les doy interés for me. I study philosophy from the secondary.
Okay.
For this reason, I understand you. Why
anyway, also, I have to carry on.
No problem. No
okay.
Problem. Thank you very much. Much appreciation
thank you.
For your help. Thank you very much. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
See you later.
So that's.
Let's go.
Intentionality, right? Well, let's read this. We're going to have finish this lecture before lunch. You see, so all the levels through which the syntheses, intentionally overlapping from subject to subject, are interwoven, form a universal unity of synthesis. Through it, the objective universe comes to be. The world which is, and as it is, concretely and vividly given, and pre-given for all possible praxis. Full stop. I didn't think there was going to be a full stop there. The intersubjective constitution of the world is the total system of manners of givenness and of modes of validity for egos. Manners of givenness over here, modes of validity for egos over there. The two combine, right? If the manners of givenness unfold in the way that the ego expects, the ego experiences actuality. That's it grants that validity. Through this constitution, the world as it is for us becomes understandable as a structure of meaning. And we're talking about that. Formed out of elementary intentionalities, not elementary particles. The being of these intentionalities themselves is nothing but one meaning formation operating together with another, constituting new meaning through synthesis. And meaning is never anything but meaning in modes of validity, that is, as related to intending ego subjects, you and me, which affect validity. Intentionality is the title which stands for the only actual and genuine way of explaining, making intelligible. To go back to the intentional origins and unities of the formation of meaning is to proceed toward a comprehension which, once achieved, which of course is an ideal case, would leave no meaningful question unanswered. Ba-dom! Boom, boom. One day, you see, I want to just do a Zohar course where everyone it just says, oh, great, next. I feel maybe I should say a couple of things. It's almost what we were.
The bit I got a question about with this particular section is the intersubjective constitution. So the intersubjective constitution of the world is that all system of manners are given us and of modes of validity for egos. So is that are the manners of givenness and modes of validity sort of negotiated between egos? You know, the intersubjective constitution. What is the intersubjective part? I know that's between egos. Is it?
Yes. So it's to do with the communalization that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
Where we come to an agreement about what is actual. And that the objective world, what we mean by the objective world, is the world that's the same for all of us.
Yeah.
Now that's a particular meaning, which is best exemplified by someone who's schizophrenic, say, or if you know anyone who's gone even a little bit mad, their view of the world starts to diverge from what we call the objective world. And the objective world, it's not personal. In the sense, going back to, the thing is, you can't even imagine a human being who didn't ever meet another human being, because that human being wouldn't even have language. And we haven't spoken about language yet, really, seriously. But it's an intersubjective world. We've come to an agreement about it at a very basic level. It's only because of our language is an intersubjective map about how to divide up the world. Do you see it's not just you open your eyes as a child and you just perceive tables and chairs and the whole structure of what you perceive, you were taught by the others, and you were taught that this is how we divide things up here. These are the colours of the rainbow. This is gravity. This feeling that the entire structure of meaning in which we live was intersubjectively formed by agreement within our culture, just like new words come in like that. I'm just using language as an example, our whole experience is structured by the way we've been taught to experience, and part of that is the deep implicit understanding that it's the same world for all of us. Now the question, and I'm not sure if this is hovering in your mind, which is really what the next lecture's about, is, but it's still the case that this is my unique experience. You know, you appear in my world, but it's still my world. You can almost feel like it's like the visual field. This is my visual field. It's absolutely personal to me. I only see the aspects that I see. And you're just not in it. And you can't even see it. Do you know, there's something. So in what way is the world intersubjective? Because there's a certain level where, no, it's utterly subjective. But what Husserl's trying to say is, but the meaning of it has been, we mean it to be intersubjective. It's another level of meaning that we have within us, and it's not just we figured it out, we actually understand it that way.
So it's like pure perception is subjective, but the meaning of that experience is intersubjective.
But in a strange sense, you see, when you say pure perception is subjective, but it's still You know, my experience of that, if it were purely subjective, my perception, I would say something like, okay, all that exists is what I'm seeing now. It would be back to the back of the bottle isn't there. Did you see? Even if there's no one here, I've objectified the bottle, because I'm projecting how it will be when I go around it. Do you know that it's not? Being objective is intimately tied up with the experience of objects. As we're going to look at later, the back of the object, even if there's no one in the universe, but you, and you could somehow have had language beamed into you, you know, from who knows where, it still contains a kind of ghostly you that could be sitting over there. Do you know the part of the subjective manners of givenness is a certain sense of what it would look like for you if you were to be in the other part of the room. So do you know, even without anyone else there, you could objectify the bottle. But the additional thing about the intersubjective world is that it turns into a world where everyone else is seeing what you're seeing. Not exactly, but they're seeing the same objects. Do you see? And that turns it into something. There's another. If without that, everything in here would not be looking back at you. Do you know? There's a. As soon as you've got other people, other consciousnesses there, the feeling, meaning of the world, suddenly becomes. It's not just my kind of movie. Yeah. It's no longer just my movie. Even with my movie, there are objects in it. It's a movie and everyone else is in it. And they're experiencing it just like I do. It, you see, the whole meaning of it is totally transformed. And I think, the reason I think of Robinson Crusoe is that if you were alone long enough, you'd probably start to forget that. But there'd still be the birds and the animals, you know, who are kind of aware of you. Do you know, utterly subjective would be the sense that there's no consciousness but yours. Which, do you see, the paradox here is, and in a way that's true too. Do you know, because there is nobody else experiencing what I'm experiencing now. Not exactly as I'm experiencing it. Do you get the... There's this interface where this absolutely unique to me personal experience is independent. You're in it.
So what do you call that personal experience then?
Well, Husserl calls it the primordial experience of the ego. So he does look at it and think that there's a primordial epoche, where, because if you go into the epoche fully, you do bracket off the consciousness of everyone else. And what he's saying is that we constitute the being of others like we constitute the being of the bottle. Only the constitution of the being of others is quite a remarkable one, because we constitute the being of others to be beings like ourselves.
Mm.
You know, it. So there's a level, you see, where if you get that, because I do, sometimes I get this, especially teaching this course, you know, you trundle through life and think, oh yeah, you know, there's a person, there's a table, there's a computer, you know, da 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 da, and everything's just a thing. But another human being is another universe. Do you know that we're utterly I don't know how to put it, but there's levels of being here, and the being of the bottle is you know, it's got quite an interesting being because you can drink it and all of that. But the being of a human being is like a star in comparison. Do you know, it's not just any old thing.
Mm.
You know, the eyes are looking at you, and there's an entire universe sitting opposite you.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to finish this, and we've only got 2 slides. All right, and this is, you know, we're traveling. I think ground that the second lecture, the final lecture, covers as well. This is Husserl often does this. He sort of softens you up, and then goes into more detail later. And of course, we've been looking at time a little bit. But the experience of time, what is time, is the... because it's philosophy of consciousness, by the way, one might forget this. And if you were to look, and this is what is the form of consciousness, well, it has intentionality, kind of, phenomenological terms, one of the key forms of consciousness is that it presents the remarkable thing about intentionality is that it presents what is not itself. You see, if consciousness being my consciousness were itself, it would just me being conscious of me. Here I am, me being conscious of me, being conscious of me. You know, I would be utterly encapsulated, like you might imagine a total subjectivity to be. But in fact, what consciousness, in the intentionality of consciousness, does is it takes this field of meaning, which is just me being conscious, and it presents something that isn't consciousness. It presents a world that's not me. I mean, it's an extraordinary thing, isn't it? That's the kind of absolute key of intentionality, is that it makes what would be, you know, just sense, it turns it into the being of the world that is not me. That's intentionality, if you like, is the agency of consciousness making, and that's the essence of consciousness for phenomenology, is that it points away from itself. Part of the essence of consciousness in phenomenology is being conscious of consciousness doing that, because in consciousness the intentionality is entirely saying the world, and it doesn't register itself that's what it's doing. It does it so seamlessly that you see the world, you don't see consciousness. But consciousness is conscious of the world. It doesn't really forget itself, it just doesn't notice itself. But the form of that, the form of my being conscious, is unified in this total synthesis that we mentioned earlier and I haven't really dwelt on. And that synthesis is what we call time. All of my experience, whether I'm imagining the past or whatever I'm doing, has this temporal structure of consciousness now. It's always now in consciousness. But you have to be clear that this now is not the clock now. Because the now in consciousness is where we think of the past now. It's where we hear the immediate past dying away now. So the past, if you like, of the objective world is still present to us in the now of consciousness. So there are two nows, really. There's what we would say, it's that exactly, you know, what the clock's measuring is this ideal mathematical point of some objective time of the world. But that objective time of the world appears in the now of consciousness, where it's it's also like a point, but the events of the world that we experience are flowing past it, and we experience the flowing of the events, and our experiencing of the flowing is an experiencing of the temporal stretched outness. So we experience the world as temporally stretched. Now. The now in which the world is stretched out is always absolutely still and present. And we, it's from there that we experience the enduring of the world, which essentially is the enduring of my enduring. Because the first thing that's continuing is my own being. And we've talked about this before, you know, we don't experience it as all chopped up. We couldn't. Even if it is out there, in some sense, an experience of frames of visual experience. All right, I'm going to read this now. Perception gives us, as far as the world is concerned, only the temporal mode of the present, which points to its horizons, the temporal modes of past and future. Stay with this. Recollection exercises the intentional function of forming the meaning of the past. You know, when I'm... The other thing that intentionality does, I feel like... when you have a memory, do you catch that the only... what makes it a memory is your intentionality. It means something that happened to me before. Otherwise, it's just a... what is it? Do you see? It's strange that we don't say, "Oh, look. Do you see that? I'm just seeing that. You know, there's somebody there that looks a lot like me doing something. Very much like I did once. But here it is, now." But we don't do that. The whole thing is it's just placed back in the entire stream of the intentional meaning of my temporal existence on Earth. And it's an extraordinary structure, even if we get it wrong. Getting it wrong is like misperceiving something. We can correct it. You know, like me going back to where I lived when I was 4. And I've got this picture. I still have the picture of the house. And the one I saw, you know, when I visited Plimstock, it was certainly the same house, but it didn't look at all like what I've got in my mind, and I still feel the one in my mind's the real one. All right, John, back to this. Recollection exercises the intentional function of forming the meaning of the past. I was just trying to embellish that. Although perception itself, as the flowing static present, I mean, what better word could you use for it? It's not like something you have to draw diagrams or pictures to try and express it, but do you feel it? There's the absolute presence of now, of pure consciousness itself, that is the space in which all time is flowing. It's static flowing. It's not flowing. It's not all flowing. It's not all static. It's the paradox of the two, which don't go together, right? Right. Something can't be still and flowing at the same time. Yes, it's logically impossible, and yet my experience is of something still flowing all the time. Okay. Although perception, yes.
Moving station.
I mean, the thing here is the, and I don't know, I know that I intuited, and it's, you know, you can talk about things out here, but the intuition of it's always being now is, I don't know how to place it really any further into language than it's always now. And there's something essentially about now that never changes, although everything changes. Everything changes, and yet there's something that doesn't change. And what doesn't change, the best analogy that you can have for it, in sense, is the space. It's the empty space in which everything appears. That's probably the closest objectification of consciousness, is the space. Do you see, the space doesn't change because there's nothing in it as space. Everything moves through it, but the space itself is just always there, and if it has to be there in order for anything to be. And consciousness is that. And generally, there's something about that direct, it's not even an experience. To speak of it, it just makes me go, you know, I can't. It's like the words are stupid, right? Because they're moving. They're not the space. You can't really indicate it. You just, it's only by a sort of a cessation that you can get a sense of it. And over the years, you know, because I've paid attention to it, you know, I find I can just, there's a certain, you know, like a little. I'm sort of aware of it in the background when I care to be. It does seem to me to be very valuable to be able to cultivate something like that in your life. Because although it's nothing, it's a kind of what's the word? How can you rely on nothing? I don't know. Rely would be the wrong word. But let me finish this. Okay, although perception itself has the flowing static present, as the flowing static present, is constituted only through the fact that the static now has a horizon with two differently structured sides, known as a continuum of retentions and protentions. So, there is this dimensionality of time where a recollection is different to a retention. And the best way that I can explain this, the most obvious retention is the sound of my voice now, as you retain what I'm saying. And you retain what I'm saying, you know, maybe a second or so of the actual sound is retained. But if I'm heading off in a long sentence, you're actually retaining the very beginning of the sentence as well, aren't you?
In theory.
But do you catch yourself, or if you listen to music, you're retaining the beginning of the phrase?
Yeah.
You music's just the same. You hear, there's a little piece, the immediate tone, the immediate phrase, you're actually holding on to that, and you actually still hear it, but the entire phrase is still with you in some way, like the intuition of the form of the bottle. The intuition of the form of what I'm saying now stays with you. Unless what I'm saying is so predictable, you don't even need to bother, because you. But you know.
It's like when you tell a joke. It's almost the same thing with music as well. You tell a joke, you go, all right, and then a punchline, and like, oh, okay. So the same thing with music as well.
Yes. Now, the distinction here is quite an important one, is as you hold on to what's immediately happened, you're not remembering it. If you remember something, it's already occurred, and when you remember it, you bring it back into the present and you replay it. And the mode in which you replay it has to have retention in it. If you remember something and you go back and you think of an event, you're walking down the street, something that somebody said, you replay that event, and the event is replayed in this retentional, protentional structure. Do you see?
Yeah, it feels like... where's the border between... Where does retention seep into recollection?
I'll tell you. When you reflect.
When you reflect.
Yeah. So the retention is something that's happening immediately now. And then in reflection, you separate from now.
Mm.
Although there's a special kind of reflection where you reflect on retention. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to do this. But reflecting on retention is a phenomenological reflection. You know, because you can actually, as I'm speaking, you can listen to, and I can, as I'm speaking, I can hear the retained sound. That's a special kind of retention, reflection, where I'm actually reflecting on the retention. But otherwise, to remember something, I turn away from now. See, retention's always happening now. My recollection is happening now, but it's a recollection of another now. And I actually, when I remember something, I create another now that I intentionally understand as being in the past, where another retention, another protention are being played out. While this, in this now, this, the actual still the protention and retention of this now is going on. Do you see only my attention is going away from this into my recollection. There's a double retention. There's still the retention of now and the retention that's going on in the recollection that I'm replaying. If you just look carefully enough, you see, yeah, retention and recollection, you've got to draw the distinction. It's terribly basic. Do you know, maybe age 7, we should be pointing this out, don't you think? I think the kids should know the basic structure of experience. I mean, it's easier than your times table. Nobody tells you, do they? It shouldn't be news to anyone. Because this is where we live. And I'm not talking about protension, which is our projection into the immediate future, because of course all of the manners of givenness that we've been going into, right, is all our protension of the future. Do you see the, and that's like the retention of the past. It's very detailed for the very next microsecond, and then it shades off into indistinctness, just like our retention is very detailed for what's just happened, and it fades off. So it's like a bell curve. Do you know, we've got this moment now, we've got our pretensions coming off and our retentions going off the other side, but the protensions are flowing into the retentions. Do you see? As what you expect at this now point meets with some kind of experience of what is. I mean, diagrammatically. This is often the experience of teaching. I remember it from university. You just pick up a whole series of pens that don't work.
Maybe I should. I mean, it's all been written on anyway. Yes, so you've got your sort of pretensions coming there, turning into retentions that are dying away there, and you've got the sort of now point here.
The thing I'd like to point out is if there's a real future, yes, it's coming from there. But we think the future is here, in our pretensions, yes? But this is like, and that's now.
So we can only experience that. Obviously.
Yeah, that's now. This, if you like, this is the future of, this is the, in a way, the unknown. This is the unknown, unthinkable source of it all. Yes? And it's at this very point we come into contact with it, at this point of consciousness now, we come into contact with it. All this stuff is the past. All of our thinking about the future and all of our experiencing of the past and all our, over here we can imagine what we're going to do, over here we've got all our recollections. It's all past. Constructions that we're making. And this little point, this now point, is our contact, if you like, with reality. Another way that I experienced it was sitting on a cart in Kuala Lumpur Airport, and it was one of these things where you're driving through it and you have to sit on the back, and there's a bench on the back, and you're just sitting looking at it's going that way, and you're sitting looking at you're just looking at everything disappearing from you, and it hit me. I think the Greeks said this too. This is how it is for us. What's coming for us in life is utterly invisible. But we kind of comfort ourselves by saying, "Oh look, there's the future. Oh look, there's future."
Well, we're facing the past.
But with the futures, we've just taken the past and utterly mechanically projected it, right? So it looks like it's coming towards us, but what we're doing is we're taking our past and projecting it into the future,
yeah.
Right? And we say, oh, it's all right. There's the past, there's the future. I know what's happening. Here I am in my life. And back here, right, there's a bullet coming for you,
yeah.
Basically. I mean, there's plenty more before the bullet, but there's definitely a bullet there.
So I got a naive image of retention, which is just a sparkler in the dark.
Yeah.
We got the spark.
Yeah, yeah. Spark is a good one for vision. Yes.
Retention out for that.
Yes. Now the sparklers are actually, that's a very good. I might steal that for another lecture, because it's like the retention of sound when you do that in the night, because. When I was trying to talk about movement, how you don't see movement. Well, a sparkler is a kind of... You do see the movement. You retain the movement with a sparkler, don't you? That's a very good example. We've still got some sparklers. We never lit them, do we? Needs to be dark, doesn't it, for it to work properly?
That's really the answer.
So, got retentions, protentions... And then recollections being quite different. In recollection, founded upon them, we have, right, because it's only if you've retained something that you remember it. Because the other thing about retention is, of course, it's been informed by that. But on the other side of that line, I know you can't see it very well, it looks a lot clearer to me. There is the inconceivable. Because whatever we conceive is the other side of that line. We think we know what's over here. We think, oh yeah, there's atoms and molecules, and no, then we're projecting that intentionality is thinking all of that. They're just forms that we're arriving at on the basis of what's coming there. That I'd like you to get just a sense of what's coming is utterly inconceivable for us, because conceivability is that side of the line. Sorry for those of you who might be listening to this who can't see the diagram. Should have come to class. It's a pretty good diagram, I reckon. Yes, these first prefigurations of temporalization, that's retention and protension, and time, remain in the background. In recollection founded upon them, in original intuition, a past which is a present which has passed, yes, it too has being. It has its multiplicities of manners of givenness, its manners of coming to original self-givenness as what has passed. Likewise, in expectation or anticipatory recollection, again understood as an intentional modification of perception, the future as a present to come, is found the meaning formation from which arises the ontic meaning of that which is in the future. Only through the all-inclusive universal synthesis which constitutes the world do all these times come together synthetically into the unity of one time. I mean, how could it... I just like just to get a sense, how do we hold it all together? How do we... How is it possible for us to imagine a future, which I do quite a lot of. You know, I'm living in a house somewhere that I've just bought. You know, I'm imagining I've moved somewhere. I even create a whole life there. And yet, I still hold it all together. It's still the one experience. I still know I'm sitting in the chair imagining a future. Do you know, and I still know what I did this morning, and I still know I've got an appointment to come. In the real future, not the one I'm imagining. Do you see how the whole lot... We don't get lost in it. We actually hold it all together around this immediate now point and make some kind of crazy sense out of it. Last slide before lunch. Nicolette was right. I really thought I was going to get the second lecture done. So the reorientation of the epoche allows us to see the purely subjective in its own self-enclosed pure context as intentionality, and to recognise it as the function of forming ontic meaning. It's at this point in the course where I think I want everyone to say, yes, yes. Have you got the purely subjective in its own... That's what we're talking about, this structure of time that we're with consciousness now, and the intentionality that's granting meaning. You see that our understanding of time is a pure granting of meaning. Time, past, time, future, these are just meanings for us. This is a whole world. And if we could equate this subjectivity with the psyche of Heraclitus, his saying would doubtless be true of it. You will never find the boundaries of the soul, even if you follow every road, so deep is its ground. Now, just so we've got the right use of the word subjectivity, this subjectivity is transcendental subjectivity. Not the little subjectivity that's centered on your body. The next lecture is all about that. There are these two subjectivities. So that it's the transcendental subjectivity that is the source of ontic meaning. Ontic is being. It grants being to everything. It grants the being of the past. It's being. It grants the being of the future. It's being. It grants the being of the present. It's being. It grants my being the meaning it has. It grants the bottle the meaning that it has. It's you know, Heidegger's entire philosophy was, what is the meaning of being? And it's he was, where did he get, I mean, he doesn't acknowledge Husserl that much, but Heidegger's, this question arose for him because in phenomenology you suddenly say, but I just thought being is. You know, the fact that this book has being is an extraordinary thing. The manner of its being. As soon as you open it up, you can you see why Husserl was in somehow he felt that he'd discovered another universe. Indeed, every ground that is reached points to further grounds. Every horizon opened up awakens new horizons. And yet the endless whole, in its infinity of flowing movement, is oriented towards the unity of one meaning. Not, of course, in such a way that we could ever simply grasp and understand the whole. Rather, as soon as one has fairly well mastered, this is supposed to be us, by the way, the universal form of meaning formation, the breadths and depths of this total meaning in its infinite totality take on valuative dimensions. There arise problems of the totality as that of a universal reason. Valuative dimensions. What is the meaning of my being conscious, for example? It's all very right, we're projecting meaning, da 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 da, but then what am I here for to do? What is the meaning of all of this meaning projection? This, we start to come into problems of universal reason then. Why are we here on earth? What's the meaning of life and death? Does transcendental subjectivity die? Was it ever born?